Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Douglas presiding.
Please be seated. First case on our docket this morning is Romani versus Shabbat of Southern Nevada, Inc. et al. If the parties are ready to go, they may proceed. Please announce your representation as you take the podium.
May it please the court, Michael Reitzel for the appellant, Teresa Romani. Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
This case is not about religion. It's about protecting victims' rights. In this case, Ms. Romani was the victim. Ms. Romani is entitled to reversal of the summary judgment in this case on several independent grounds. I'd like to touch upon four of those today. The first three relate to the retaliation she alleged and claims such as negligent infliction of emotional distress, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and breach of fiduciary duty. The fourth independent ground relates to the negligent retention cause of action. The first three retaliation allegations made by Arisa Romani go to retaliation in the form of sexual coercion by Rabbi Harlig. The second, retaliation in the form of an ongoing investigation into whether Ms. Romani was Jewish. Third, retaliation in the form of Ms. Romani's son being mistreated. And the fourth independent ground is the synagogue's negligent retention of an admitted sex offender. The only arguments that were made by the respondents during the summary judgment in this case were that the First Amendment was a bar to all of these claims. The excessive entanglement doctrine in that, in the second one, Michael Segelstein was not an employee of the synagogue. Those were the only two arguments that were made in support of that motion for summary judgment. Before I dive into some of the independent grounds, I think it's important to go through very briefly some of the key facts that got us here today. Ms. Romani was sexually assaulted in April of 2001 by a synagogue official. After that assault occurred, Ms. Romani went to her rabbi, Rabbi Harlig, and told him about the incident, seeking to keep it within the Jewish community. His immediate response was that he did not believe her. She then believed that she needed to report this to the authorities, which she did. Once she reported it to the authorities, things began to change for Ms. Romani. The synagogue intensified the investigation into whether she was Jewish and started ostracizing her son from the Jewish community. After she reported it and after these things began occurring, Mr. Segelstein actually went to Rabbi Harlig and admitted that he had committed the sexual assault that Ms. Romani had complained of. And at various times throughout this ordeal, Rabbi Harlig went to Ms. Romani and told her, "I will make this go away if you engage in a sexual relationship with me." Ms. Romani initially rebuffed these efforts, but in September of 2001, she ultimately relented and did engage in a sexual relationship with Rabbi Harlig.
Where in the record is the proof of what you just said with respect to your client being told by Rabbi Harlig that she needed to give him sexual favors for him to assist her?
Well, a couple points there. First in the complaint, in paragraphs 33 and 38, the allegations were made by Ms. Romani.
Right, but where's the proof for summary judgment purposes?
She then subsequently did an affidavit that was done initially in response to the counterclaim filed by Rabbi Harlig That's in the record in volume one, I believe page 152 that began. But she also submitted that very same affidavit, which very specifically went through the sexual coercion that occurred, and she submitted that in support of the opposition to her motion for summary judgment. That is in volume three, pages 500 through 505, that she submitted that affidavit in support of the opposition.
Did the judge consider that in his ruling, or as far as you know?
It's unclear when you look at the ruling. I think when you look at what the judge did in the lower court, essentially he dismissed all of the affidavits. He never specifically referenced the one that discussed the sexual coercion facts. He did address some of the other ones that she had submitted, I believe, and it's in the record around page 918 in volume 5. She submitted one herself and an additional one by Joel Hoffman, and also a congregant, and the court dismissed those. I believe Joel Hoffman's was dismissed because of the discovery issue, saying that he was never brought about an initial discovery, therefore he can't submit an affidavit. And hers, why it was dismissed is also a little unclear. She provided personal knowledge of her accounts, and the judge seemed to ignore it. And I think that's also what happened with the affidavit that she submitted in opposition to the summary judgment that Justice Pickering was asking about. Ultimately, Michael Segelstein was convicted of a crime for the initial assault that took place. Subsequently, Ms. Romani then filed the complaint in this action. When we look at the three independent grounds for retaliation, the court dismissed those because of the bar by the First Amendment. That was the only argument made by the respondents, and that was the only reason why the court dismissed those claims. But this case is not about religion, and it never was about religion. Coercing sex from a congregant has nothing to do with the Jewish faith. It wouldn't matter what church we were in. That kind of action is secular, tortious conduct, and it should not be permitted to occur in this court, and the lower court is able to adjudicate claims based upon those facts.
Mr. Reitzel, assuming that view of the case, which of the 17 causes of action applies to Rabbi Harlig?
Very specific.
Certainly you don't maintain they all do.
That's
under
correct.
That point.
That's very correct.
So could you identify which of the 17 causes of action, in your view, apply to Rabbi Harlig for this first argument of retaliation?
I would point to three separate causes of action on that. And we've really only addressed some of the 17. Obviously, there was a lot in there. But the three that directly go to the conduct by Rabbi Harlig would be negligent infliction of emotional distress, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and a breach of a fiduciary duty. Those very specifically go to the conduct by Rabbi Harlig, and there's nothing about that conduct that would allow summary judgment of those claims.
Does the recognition of a breach of fiduciary duty claim require this court to address the First Amendment defenses to it?
It does not specifically require the court to do that, but the court obviously needs to consider whether this would be a case, say, of simply clergy malpractice versus a breach of fiduciary duty. And I believe this court can draw a line between those two things based upon the conduct. For example, if you look at a situation in which a rabbi would simply be counseling someone and maybe make an error in judgment or simply make a mistake while performing the duties as a clergy member, that falls more into the realm of clergy malpractice. And that type of thing is based upon religious beliefs, faith, and the duties of a rabbi. In a situation like we have here, coercing sex from a congregant has nothing to do with religion. When you simply use your a special relationship you've created for secular conduct that goes outside the scope of what your duties are, that's a breach of fiduciary duty.
Well, counsel, what's your authority that this is a fiduciary relationship between your client and the rabbi? Why? Because we've recognized that, employer-employee, we got a handful of relationships we would recognize as being special or fiduciary. I don't think this is one of them, but am I wrong on that?
Well, this court has never specifically brought up the issue of a rabbi and a congregant, or someone who, a clergy member and a congregant.
Right.
Not specifically done that. There are numerous cases that have simply addressed that as a special relationship. And we're asking the court to adopt, looking at that special relationship that's created between a rabbi and a congregant, very similar to if even an attorney-client relationship, for example. If an attorney made a mistake in his representation of a client, that falls sort of in the attorney malpractice, and the focus would be on the duties of the attorney. But in a situation where maybe that attorney acted far outside the scope of what he was permitted to do, that would go much more to a breach of fiduciary duty outside the scope of malpractice. It's no longer malpractice when you take advantage of the relationship you have and then do secular acts outside of that when you're talking about the religious context. In several cases, I think you can look at the Supreme Court of Colorado on a couple of occasions, and the Moses case mentioned very specifically about the fiduciary duty that, or the fiduciary relationship that does exist, and it more is about the conduct that's involved there. If that answers your question, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, David Frederick of Lionel, Sawyer, and Collins, on behalf of the respondents, one of whom, Rabbi Harlig, is here today. I hope to be able to address remarks to three topics. One, summary judgment, and in particular, summary judgment in this case. Second, what has come to be called the church autonomy doctrine and what it covers and what it doesn't cover. And that goes to the questions about fiduciary duty that have been raised. And thirdly, the question of duty with respect to churches as their voluntary organizations. Because what has happened in the briefing in this case is that the language of employment law has been shifted to church-parishioner relationships. You heard a great deal this morning about retaliation. In the briefing, you hear about sexual harassment. You hear about negligent supervision and retention. All of these are employment doctrines. And there are employment issues in this case that are fully briefed. But they're being used in the issues that are being addressed this morning, not with respect to the employment issues, but with respect to the relationship between a clergyman and a member of the congregation. And that's where the First Amendment comes in. Let's talk a little about
something. Before you get there, Mr. Frederick, if you set aside the various legal doctrines that you've talked about, why doesn't negligent infliction of emotional distress or intentional infliction of emotional distress survive summary judgment simply in a circumstance where it is alleged that a demand for sex was made by the rabbi?
I'll get to the second portion of your question in a minute, because there's a serious misrepresentation of the record being made with respect to that demand and with respect to the affidavit that Justice Pickering inquired about. The first portion of your question, intentional infliction of emotional distress is easy to dispose of. It requires extreme and outrageous conduct. That's conduct beyond all realm of decency, intolerable in a civilized community. There are a number of courts that have recognized that sexual relationships between adults, even if they occur, don't meet that requirement. Let's talk a minute about negligent infliction of emotional distress. Negligent infliction of emotional distress requires a duty, and a duty to refrain from inflicting emotional distress. That is fundamentally inconsistent with the First Amendment. There are a great many religions for whom infliction of emotional distress is an essential part of the repentance, redemption process.
Okay, on those two points, Mr. Frederick, if you could bear with me. With respect to the intentional infliction of emotional distress between two adults, the district court judge does not appear to have addressed that point because summary judgment was based entirely on First Amendment. As to the negligent inflection issue, possibly the First Amendment issue addressed the duty question, but that's not clear at all from the record of the order entered by the judge. Could you address those two points?
First of all, it's not accurate to say, and this also gets to the second point with respect to Justice Pickering's questions, it is not accurate to say that the summary judgment motion was based strictly on the First Amendment. That summary judgment motion included affidavits. It also included the interrogatory answers that Ms. Romani had submitted. Those interrogatory answers plus the affidavits set up the factual context in which the legal arguments were made, and the legal arguments provided grounds for summary judgment. And in particular, those two interrogatory responses, they're found at pages 450 and 451 of the record, in which Ms. Romani made it clear that the sexual assault in question here and the battery, i.e., non-consensual touching in question here, was by Mr. Sagelstein. And that is the only one that is identified in those interrogatories. And that is why you find on the briefing on summary judgment, you don't find any of Ms. Romani's deposition testimony with respect to her claim of sexual relations with Rabbi Harley, because that claim, the coercion of sexual relations that is being touted this morning in the brief, was simply never alleged. It wasn't part of the basis. Now, Mr. Reitzel referred to the fact that there was an affidavit in which...
Mr. Frederick, it is alleged in the complaint in paragraphs 35 and 38.
What is alleged in the complaint is the offer of favors for sexual relations. Now we get to the problem of moving employment language into the relationship between a clergyman and the members of the congregation.
Before you go there, would you agree that there was sufficient proof put forward in the summary judgment context of the allegation of a request for sexual favors? I understand that that's controverted and denied, but was there adequate evidentiary proof opposing summary judgment with an affidavit properly before the court that said, when I went to ask for investigation of what occurred with the cantor, here is what happened to me. I was asked to give sexual favors to the person in charge of the investigation.
Not with respect to the allegations that Ms. Romani is making in support of her claims. And the reason why I say that is this. This affidavit that Mr. Reitzel referred to was an affidavit that was filed in opposition to Mr. Harlig's defamation counterclaim. Now, he also mentioned that the affidavit was argued on summary judgment, but the argument had nothing to do with Ms. Romani's claims. The argument was summary judgment should not be entered in favor of Mr. Harlig on his counterclaim. At no point was there ever either an argument or a motion to amend or any procedural device that would assert a coerced sexual relationship in this case. And under the recently decided Shuck case, that becomes of critical importance. It is unfair to say to these respondents, well, we know that the district court entered summary judgment on the claims alleged. We know that the district court entertained two separate proceedings before doing so. But now we can pick portions of the record, put them together in support of a sexual abuse claim by Rabbi Harlig, and have a trial after the fact when that claim was never defended below, never alleged below. The allegation that you referred to, Justice Pickering, is offered. The difficulty is that that offer of sexual relations in exchange for favors is not inherently wrongful. It does become wrongful in the employment law context, and it is one of many examples of what the appellant has tried to do in this case, and that is by way of the characterization, move employment law into the as determinative of the relationship between a clergyman and a parishioner. That's where the First Amendment comes in, because that is a relationship that is determined within the religious context by the ecclesiastical courts, not the civil courts. And this goes to the questions you raised, Justice Hardesty, about fiduciary duty. The question, where comes the fiduciary duty in this context, is the critical question. And the reason it's the critical question is because if you engage in that kind of a discourse with respect to a religious relationship between a clergyman and their parishioner, you have the civil courts attempting to articulate and then enforce the contours of an inherently religious relationship. Now, does that mean, as the reply brief in this case screams at length, the clergymen are granted immunity for misconduct? The answer is no. What it does mean is where the grounds for that misconduct, where the duty that is breached arises from a religious relationship, it's not the function of the civil courts to adjudicate it. On the other hand, if it is a duty that runs to the public at large, if we're dealing not simply with an offer, but we're dealing with a sexual assault, for example, that liability depends not at all on the existence or absence of a relationship between the parties. That's the difference between, for example, the kind of claims which could be maintained against Mr. Segalstein in this case and the claims that can be maintained against the respondents in this case. Nobody claims, and certainly not in this litigation, that clergymen are immune from liability for sexual assault, abuse, exploitation. But insofar as you base a claim on something like breach of fiduciary duty or breach of duty of trust and confidence, if the civil courts start in articulating the contours of that duty, that's where the First Amendment steps in. And that's what the context of what is called in the briefs the church autonomy doctrine operates. What is the retaliation that is claimed here? The retaliation that is claimed here is an investigation of Ms. Romani's Jewish heritage, a matter which is unquestionably within the sphere of religious authorities. And because it involves not just membership, but qualifications for membership, that are inherently religious in nature, it is matter that is solely within the realm of the ecclesiastical courts. Likewise, the second form of retaliation here, which was the treatment given to her son with respect to participation in religious educational programs and with respect to participation in religious services. Again, dealing with a matter solely within the realm of ecclesiastical authorities. And it doesn't gain liability by attaching the employment word retaliation to it. The fact is, churches are voluntary organizations. And this brings me to the last point I want to address. And that is, parishioners cannot use the civil courts to redefine the relationship between clergyman and the parishioner, the congregation and clergyman. These are matters for the ecclesiastical courts. And so as Ms. Romani complains, as she did in her complaint, about the treatment of her son and about a religious investigation, because though none of that rises to the level of inherently wrongful conduct, i.e. wrongful conduct that exists without regard to the relationship between the parties, it is not cognizable in the civil courts. And that, to go back to your point, Justice Hardy, see, that's the basis upon which, at the end of the day, liability on summary judgment was rejected by the district court below. Not because the summary judgment motion only argued legal points, but because in the context provided by the affidavits, by the interrogatory answers, by the other materials that eventually emerged on summary judgment, this was not a matter for the civil courts. Thank you.
Thank you again, Your Honors. Mr. Frederick brought up the point of intentional infliction of emotional distress and says you can just throw that one right out, that this is certainly not extreme and outrageous conduct. You'd never even get past that part of the test. Well, this is one of those cases in which you can walk right out on the street and talk to any person, and you can ask them, and you tell them what happened, and their response is going to be, this was outrageous. You simply can't dismiss what occurred here and say that claim wasn't good enough, because that's really the argument that they made. They say that it was...
Well, actually, Mr. Reitzel, that's not the argument I heard, and I'd like you to address the argument that I think I heard, which was that intentional infliction of emotional distress was not a claim or cause of action against the rabbi in the context of the affidavit that was submitted or in the context of the complaint as alleged, that the sexual conduct described in the answers to interrogatories dealt specifically with the cantor.
I understand that maybe that's how it came out, but I don't believe that's really what they're saying. If you look specifically at that interrogatory, which I just did while we were sitting there, it asks about what defendant assaulted you.
Mm-hmm.
And is it okay, consensual sex or sex between adults may not necessarily be assault. And that was what that claim was about, because she made a claim for assault. It didn't say which one of the defendants intentionally inflicted emotional distress on you. And when you take the affidavit that she put together and the facts that are in this case, the facts are certainly there to support that as a separate claim of an intentional...
I understand you weren't the counsel when this was argued below in the district court, but Mr. Frederick maintains that when this was argued in district court, the factual events described in the affidavit were not part of the argument made by the plaintiff's counsel to support the intentional infliction of emotional distress cause of action. Is that true?
That I don't even know. That's something I'm not. Mr. Frederick also was not the counsel for the respondents below. So I'm not sure what actually was argued at that time. But if you look at the opposition to the motion for summary judgment, you know, it's not the most beautifully drafted document, but it's very long and it includes allegations that go directly to those claims.
Does it argue, though, that intentional infliction and negligent infliction with respect to the claim involving the allegations against the rabbi, leaving aside the Cantor case, does it argue that there's sufficient facts with respect to those claims to proceed on them? Does it make even that much of an argument?
Sometimes it's very difficult to tell the arguments that were being made in opposition, and we certainly recognize that. Because in this case, you had someone drafting a summary judgment opposition on her own, who all she really thought she could do was sort of provide the facts that would support the causes of action she included in her complaint. And she did that in an affidavit that very clearly brought up conduct that fits well within intentional infliction of emotional distress and negligent infliction of emotional distress. To say that asking someone to have sex with you in return for personal favors is not inherently wrongful is sort of shocking. That could easily cause someone emotional distress, particularly when it involves the situation we had here. It wasn't even so much the fact that maybe that sexual relationship occurred. The simple act of putting that out there, that's what's alleged in the complaint, very easily could cause someone emotional distress.
Counsel, can I ask you to address one other point Mr. Frederick made on the fiduciary duty issue? He's basically arguing that we can't add breach of fiduciary duty to a parishioner clergy relationship because of we get into the inner workings of various religions and all like that. And what's your comment to that?
Well, like I had sort of discussed before, we brought up the issue of when you've stepped outside of what's involved with that relationship, you're no longer in this sort of clergyman congregant relationship. I may continue to
finish your thought.
When you've done that, you have completely taken yourself outside of that relationship. In this court, in the lower court below, is certainly not involving religious doctrine or religious belief when all they're looking at is the particular conduct of the clergyman involved. And if we were to allow clergymen in any type of religion just to commit conduct and step back and say, wait a second, we can hide behind the fact that this was just religious. I'm a clergyman. She was a congregant. I'm allowed to do what I want.
But Mr. Fred, I think, made the point you could sue for clergy malpractice. There may be a different tort involved than breach of fiduciary duty.
When you look carefully, though, at some of the law that we have cited in this case, you'll note that the clergy malpractice does fall into a different category, and that's the kind of act that would easily be summarily dismissed. But when it's taken outside that context, it's no longer part of that relationship, and it's no longer a church autonomy doctrine, it's a church immunity doctrine, and that shouldn't be allowed here.
Great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Court thanks the parties for the argument this morning. There were a number of issues that were of interest to the court. That's why it was set for oral argument this day. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.